exactly on time. Much on time. We've talked quite a bit about governance in the Miller Center in recent months, and yet we have not had as many people who deal with the interaction of branches of government, of units within the single branches of government. And it's partly for that reason that we're very pleased that Professor Shirley Ann Warsaw has kindly consented to speak to us about White House control of domestic policy. And I gather that although she is a leading Eisenhower specialist and scholar, that much of what we'll hear will be on the Reagan administration, which is fine. We're still completing the Reagan oral history that we've been involved in, so that's very timely for us. Dr. Warsaw is professor of political science at Gettysburg College. She's director of the Dwight Eisenhower Symposium at the college and of Washington programs. And I mentioned to Herbert Brownell that we were going to invite you and that you had agreed to speak. He said, "That's wonderful. She's very able." So praise from Herbert Brownell is something that all of us greatly respect. She's also associate director of the Eisenhower Leadership Center. She holds the PhD from Johns Hopkins University, the master's degree from the Wharton School of Finance, and a bachelor's degree from the University of Pennsylvania. Her publications include The Eisenhower Legacy, Re-examining the Eisenhower Presidency, and a forthcoming book, Power Sharing, Cabinet Government in the Modern Presidency, all of them very much related. She and I also, for our sins, have been contributors to the volumes published by the Hofstra Conference on the Presidency, and she's had at least four contributions to that and has also written a number of things in such journals as the Presidential Studies volume that is published in New York City. She served as a consultant to the Domestic Policy Council of the White House, to the National Advisory Council for the Center for the Study of the Presidency in New York. She'd been a member of that body. She's a member of the Finnegan Foundation Board of Directors. She's a consultant to PBS, or was, for the six-hour series on the Eisenhower legacy. And she's a member of the Board of Directors of the Eisenhower Society. So she brings a rich background to our subject. Last but not least, both her parents received graduate degrees from the University of Virginia. So
we're Thank you. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. I'm just delighted to be here. Ken said both my parents went to graduate school at the University of Virginia and have talked about it for many years. They love it here, and I have never been here, and I'm just very honored to finally get to the University of Virginia and see what a wonderful campus you have. Ken asked me to talk about domestic policy making. I'm sorry, I'm not going to talk about the Eisenhower administration. As much as I love the Eisenhower administration, I've been branching out to the more modern presidency and am focusing most of my work right now on White House cabinet relations in the modern presidency, that's Nixon on. And in particular, I'm looking at how the White House controls policymaking in the domestic arena, not in the foreign policy arena, but in the domestic arena. And today I'm going to talk about the Reagan administration, simply because in recent years, every single president, you all can remember all of the campaigns in recent years, have argued that presidents should reduce the power of the White House staff and give more power to the cabinet for policymaking. And this is a trend that really began in the Johnson years. Remember, there was no White House staff before Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Franklin Delano Roosevelt created the White House staff for the Reorganization Act. But Roosevelt and Truman and Eisenhower really didn't build much of a White House staff. Eisenhower, of those three presidents, was the first president to build a serious White House staff. He created, as you all know, a press secretary, for instance, a scheduler, a cabinet secretary, numerous, not numerous, but quite a few people. Then John F. Kennedy came along, and Kennedy began to expand the White House staff, and that staff was truly expanded in the Johnson years. And I think all of you remember Joe Califano was the first to begin to gain control of policymaking at the White House level. Now, you'll see the White House beginning to gain control of policymaking in direct relationship to the increase in the federal budget. You're talking about a federal budget of $9 billion in 1940. There was not much of a role for the federal government. We saw states' rights and states' activism controlling the policy process. And then with the New Deal, we saw the emergence of the federal government as a policymaker. And that emergence grew and grew and grew. It was stifled a bit under the Eisenhower administration, particularly as you saw the Congress, the Republican Congress, particularly under Congressman Halleck, urging the federal government not to take a dominant role in policymaking, but to leave that to the states. The Kennedy era began to look again at the federal government as the focus of policymaking, and Kennedy began to build a White House staff, and that staff really proliferated in the Johnson years. Now, Richard Nixon campaigned on a pledge. He saw the Great Society as being totally White House-based and wanted to reverse that trend, give policymaking back to, one, the departments, but even more so with the new federalism back to the states. Am I talking too fast?
No, you're fine.
Am I okay? Please stop me. At any time, please stop and we can talk about any of these issues.
We don't have what the baseball stadiums have. So many miles an hour on each pitch.
But please feel free to just stop me at any moment. So Nixon wanted to reverse the trend of policymaking moving into the White House. And he campaigned on a pledge of what's called cabinet government, in which we would rebuild a strengthened cabinet, put policymaking back to the cabinet, reduce the role of the White House staff, and in part he hoped this would be the beginning of a trend back to a state-oriented policymaking system. Nixon began his administration with a cabinet-based system. He brought in Daniel Patrick Moynihan, as you remember, to head the Urban Affairs Council, and to do very limited policymaking in the White House. Part of this was because Richard Nixon firmly believed that foreign policy is where the president's time needed to be spent. And he wanted to reduce the role of the federal government in domestic policymaking, and he certainly wanted to reduce the role of the White House staff in domestic policymaking. But Richard Nixon very soon found that the cabinet officers had been quite easily co-opted by their departments, and that the departments were pursuing policies which lacked either his political interest or his programmatic interests. By programmatic, I mean they were pursuing policies that in fact went against his goal of reducing the role of the federal government, and certainly his role of reducing the federal budget. I don't know if you remember Secretary Romney at HUD. Secretary Romney actually wanted to see an increased role for what's called the Model Cities Program, which is a program that Lyndon Johnson had supported. Richard Nixon went on the record during the campaign and said, I don't want to see model cities, I want to see it cut, destroyed, essentially. George Romney went to Congress and said, I don't care what the President of the United States wants, I want to see that program continued. Robert Finch, who was the Secretary of HEW, it was HEW before it was HHS, Robert Finch, who had been Lieutenant Governor of California, somebody that Richard Nixon had great personal confidence in, wanted also to see a burgeoning of social services program in spite of Richard Nixon's pledge to reduce the role of the federal government policymaker. So all of the, and there's also the classic case of Walter Hickel. Walter Hickel, as you remember, had been in Secretary of Interior, and Walter Hickel was campaigning, one, against the war, wanted us pulled out of the war, publicly went out campaigning and said, we want to reduce the United States' role in Vietnam without talking to President Nixon. And there was also a movement in the Everglades. Richard Nixon had campaigned to put a major airport in the Everglades, not in the park, but right outside of it, to service that portion of Florida. And Walter Hickel went on record as saying, we're not going to do what the president wants. So everywhere you turn, Richard Nixon saw his cabinet officers as being co-opted by the departments. And he said, all right, I've had it. We're getting rid of policymaking in the departments. We're moving it back into the departments, into the White House. So he created what's called the Domestic Council. And in 1970, He signed an executive order to create an in-house policy mechanism to provide domestic policy advice to the president on parallel to the National Security Council, which, as you know, had been institutionalized and part of the White House staff since 1947. The domestic council began to operate under a man. Anybody remember who it operated under? No, that was the Urban Affairs Council, the domestic council. In 70, when he created the domestic council, he essentially fired Moynihan, which Moynihan still is extremely bitter about. And he fired Arthur Burns, too. Who took over as Richard Nixon's chief domestic policy advisor? It's a name from the past.
Ehrlichman,
exactly. John Ehrlichman. And John Ehrlichman centralized policymaking in the White House. So for the remainder of the Nixon administration, we had a very, very tightly controlled policy process where the departmental policy initiatives came out of the White House, and the departments were told essentially what to do in policy development. Anything the department wanted to do had to be run through the White House. And the White House staff burgeoned and burgeoned and burgeoned, and you had enormous White House staff. Gerald Ford came into office in August of 1974, and looked at this staff and felt that that huge White House staff, which had controlled policymaking, had in fact insulated Nixon and been part of the problem that led to Watergate. So Gerald Ford said, I don't want a centralized White House staff, I'm going to rely on my cabinet, in the same way that Richard Nixon had in fact said when he campaigned in 1968, and he began to do that. But Gerald Ford had a problem. He came into office in 1974 with a very reinvigorated cabinet because during 1974, the White House staff was in such disarray that the cabinet had essentially moved onto its own and become a very independent force in policymaking. Gerald Ford, therefore, inherited a government with a very strong cabinet policy development system, and he moved immediately to take control of it. He moved first with Al Haig, who knew he had to take control of it. When Haig left after a month, he brought in Donald Rumsfeld to head the White House staff, and when Rumsfeld moved over to defense, he had Dick Cheney in there as chief of staff. All of these people knew that they needed to gain control of the policymaking process, that the departments were off on their own. You had an energy department, for instance, in which, not an energy department, it's called the Federal Energy Council at the time, it was the precursor to the energy department, that was advocating major tax increases for gas while Gerald Ford was saying, no, we don't want a tax increase. You have to gain control of the policy process. So Gerald Ford tried to do that, but Gerald Ford had a very difficult White House staff, terrible infighting, and he never gained control of the policy process. Jimmy Carter entered office also saying, I need to gain control of the domestic policy process. But Jimmy Carter, who viewed Watergate as a major problem in insulating the president, did as Richard Nixon had done. He gave power to the cabinet officers. Very quickly, by the summer of 1979, he also realized that his department heads had been totally co-opted by the cabinet officers. The policies coming out of the departments did not in any way meet his needs. There are, as in the Nixon administration, there are classic examples. Griffin Bell, who was his attorney general, Jimmy Carter said, now, Griffin, I can't relate this exact conversation to you. I've read all the memos back and forth between the president and Griffin Bell, but essentially the conversation went something like this. President Carter said, Griffin, you realize that we have an election coming up in 1980, and we have some problems. One of those is a religion problem that I fear we've lost the Catholic vote. Griffin Bell said, fine, I don't disagree with you. You know, what can we do for you? And Jimmy Carter said, well, I figured this out. I think we can regain the Catholic vote if we can enhance the parochial school system. And one way to enhance the parochial school system is to actually provide them some funds. And Jimmy Carter's White House staff, Stu Eisenstadt, had come up with an idea in which they would put CETA funds. Now, CETA funds, for those of you that don't know, is the Comprehensive Employment Training Act. It's now defunct, but it was alive and well in 1977-78. Carter said, well, we'll just give them CETA funds. Attorney General said, sir, I think that's a great idea. There's just one little problem. Anybody know what the problem could be? Sure. It violated the First Amendment. It was giving federal funds to a church related endeavor. So Griffendahl said, sir, I just don't think we can do this. And Carter said, I don't care what you think, do it. Well, Griffendahl ended up doing it. But Carter was furious that Griffendahl would bring the Constitution into what were very political needs. Now, one doesn't think of Jimmy Carter as that political, but he was extremely political. He eventually, as I said, within about a year and a half, became so angry at his cabinet, he fired half of them. And the ones that were left, he said, listen, I don't want one thing coming out of these departments that isn't cleared with Stu Eisenstadt first. And he put Hamilton Jordan. He swore in the campaign, I'll never have a chief of staff. Well, he ended up putting Hamilton Jordan in as his chief of staff. So Hamilton Jordan and Jack Watson and Stu Eisenstadt tightly controlled the development of domestic policy making. Now, Ronald Reagan, who is, in my estimation, the only president in recent years, and that includes George Bush and Bill Clinton, who we can get into a little bit later, who has really looked at the institution of the presidency and examined the problems that that institution has had in one, policymaking, and two, its relations with Congress. And Ronald Reagan said, listen, what we need to do is build a relationship with the cabinet. We need the cabinet. They control an awful lot of money. They control an awful lot of people. We can't be at war with the cabinet. And he turned to his White House staff and said, let's not give them sole responsibility for policymaking. That's crazy. Let's build a team approach. Nobody in all of these years that we've talked about since Franklin Delano Roosevelt had really built a team approach between a strong White House staff and a cabinet. And what we're going to focus on for the rest of my time here is what Ronald Reagan did to facilitate this very strong working relationship between a White House staff and a cabinet. And if I looked at people around this table and I said, of all of the recent presidents, beginning with Nixon, who would you say had the strongest presidency? This is not to say you agree or disagree with the programs that came out of it, but which of the presidents was most successful in succeeding in what they said they would do? Ronald Reagan, no question about it. One of the reasons for that is because Ronald Reagan knew how to forge this very strong working relationship between all of the people around him. There was no jockeying for power. The great failure of the Ford administration was the terrible jockeying for power among the White House staffers. There was no jockeying for power either among the White House staff or between the White House staff and the cabinet. They all had a single goal in mind. Now, let me sort of narrow my focus right now and focus only on how did Reagan do this? Well, the first thing that Reagan did is if you're going to have a very strong cabinet-White House relationship, anybody want to take a guess? What would you do? You're going to surround yourself with people you trust. If you look around at the people in the Nixon administration, the Ford administration, the Carter administration, the cabinet people, what comes to mind? Were they close friends of those presidents? No, they weren't. One of the things that those presidents wanted to do, particularly Jimmy Carter, was create a political base with the cabinet. This goes back to the Jacksonian era, almost a spoil system. And what Jimmy Carter wanted to do was make sure that his cabinet had women in it, had minorities in it, had geographic diversity in it, had ethnic diversity, that the cabinet represented all of America. To do that, he brought in people he didn't know. He'd never met most of those people before the original, their initial meetings. Ronald Reagan said, no, I won, folks, by over 9%. That's a huge margin, in presidential elections. Remember that Richard Nixon had won by less than 1%, and Gerald Ford, of course, wasn't an election. The Ford-Carter election, I think, was 2.5% margin. So these people had relatively narrow margins. Ronald Reagan won by 9.7%. That's a very substantial margin to win a presidency. As we all know in watching recent presidents. So he said, I don't need to build any further political bases. I don't need to use my cabinet to ensure a greater mandate than I already have. I'm going to surround myself with people I know, people I trust, people that have the same agenda that I do. So he went out and he brought in an old friend, Pendleton James. Pendleton James was a Los Angeles personnel recruiter who was in the same social circles that Ronald Reagan was in, whom he knew for social reasons, and had gotten his personnel recruitment from the Nixon administration. He had been Frederick Malick. Frederick Malick was Richard Nixon's personnel chief, and Pendleton James had been deputy director under Frederick Malick. So he had this internal White House experience. He had external experience, and Reagan loved him personally. So he said to Pendleton James, before the nomination, folks, let's start thinking about, if I should win, who would I bring in? So James was slowly building up names. Well, the minute that Ronald Reagan was nominated for the presidency, Ronald Reagan put together $80,000, set James up in Alexandria, Virginia, with an office, and said, you begin the recruitment process. Well, James started assembling names, and he met frequently with a group of Reagan's personal friends, Joseph Kors, William French Smith, Caspar Weinberger, Charles Zwick. And these people, along with Pendleton James, put together a list of names for the cabinet. So they were ready to go once Reagan won the election. I should tell you that none of these people were contacted before the election. They simply weren't. However, the day of the election, Pendleton James met with Ronald Reagan and Ed Meese, some of his friends, at their Pacific Palisades home. Reagan said, have you got the list to James? James said, I've got the list, let's go for it. And they started calling people that day. Now, what had happened is that James had brought down a short list, and that short list had three criteria. Are you a Reagan man? And I say man with great seriousness. They didn't look at women. We had had this history in recent administrations of including gender diversity in the cabinet, but women were never considered in any seriousness for the Reagan cabinet. They brought in Jean Kirkpatrick, as you remember, for ambassador to the UN with cabinet status, but that's very arguable because, as you know, the ambassador to the UN reports to whom?
Secretary
of State with cabinet status. So you certainly are not officially going to have two cabinet people reporting one to another. So they gave her that status in large part because she was a woman, and they wanted to have a woman, quote unquote, in the cabinet. The questions that they asked themselves were, are you a Reagan man? That is, had you been actively supportive of the Reagan presidency? Are you a conservative? Not just did you support the Republican ticket, but are you a conservative? And three, do you support the Reagan agenda? But supporting the Reagan agenda and being conservative were slightly different. Now, James picked all of Reagan's cabinet officers, and they were all people who, not necessarily who Reagan knew, but who had the same exact focus. They were all basically the same age as Reagan. Reagan did not like people who were not of that vein. He liked to surround himself with people that had a great deal in common with him, and James knew that. Now, there were three exceptions to the cabinet selection process. One, anybody could take a guess at what those are? When you graduate students. Well, the Secretary of the Interior was one. James Watt was nominated for Secretary of the Interior. Senator Paul Laxalt of Nevada was an old friend of Reagan's, and he said, I want to choose that person. Laxalt had a huge sheep farm in Nevada and wanted to make sure that farm was essentially protected and wanted to make sure the Secretary of the Interior was somebody that he could trust. And he had been an old friend of James Watt, who was a farmer in Wyoming, and brought in Watt. The second was the position of Secretary of the Energy. After Pendleton James had assembled all these cabinet positions and had essentially announced them, Strom Thurmond went just bonkers and said, Mr. President, I look at this list and I notice there's no one from the South here. The President said, oh, gee, I didn't notice that. And luckily, their nominee for Secretary of Energy withdrew because he didn't want to have his finances revealed before the Senate. Strom and Thurmond said, see that position that's open? Can I have that, sir? And the President said, yes. And Strom Thurmond nominated his close and dear friend, James Edwards, who was a dentist who had been governor of the state of South Carolina. And the third was John Block, who was Secretary of Agriculture, who Bob Dole said, I want to make sure that agriculture is protected, and he brought in his friend Bob, John Block. The fourth is somewhat iffy, is Malcolm Baldrige of Commerce, was a friend of George Bush's, and there is substantial evidence that George Bush pushed him. But except for those people, the cabinet was totally selected by Pendleton James to meet these very narrow standards. Then came the White House staff, and as all presidents do, Reagan simply moved in the White House staff. Anybody remember who the White House staff were? Ed Meese.
Baker.
Jim Baker.
Deaver.
Michael Deaver. His three key campaign aides were moved into the White House. So the people surrounding the president, both in the White House and the cabinet, were people of his age, of his social background, and people who he had a great deal personally in common with. So it was great camaraderie among this group, which you didn't see in any of the other administrations. And most importantly, they all shared this absolutely clear view of where they wanted to take government. The next thing that happened in building this strong White House cabinet relation is that Reagan needed to establish an organizational structure for ensuring that his White House had control, for lack of a better word, over the domestic policy process. And he needed to ensure that the cabinet office just didn't become co-opted and didn't move in directions other than what the president himself wanted. So the first thing he did was to build up the White House staff. All the other presidents had taken office and reduced the White House staff. When Ronald Reagan took office, there were 51 people in 1981 on the senior White House staff. Now, that doesn't include the military aide, it doesn't include the vice president's staff, it doesn't include the first lady's staff, or most of the administrative offices. Those are the senior people responsible to the president with title assistant to the president, special assistant to the president, deputy assistant to the president, that have policymaking responsibilities on the White House staff. There are 51 of those. In less than a year, there were 82. So there was more than a 50% increase of key White House staff within that first year for policymaking responsibilities. What Reagan then did is establish what's called the Cabinet Council System. And he did that very, very cleverly through an office on the White House staff called the Office of Policy Development, the OPD. Nixon had created the Domestic Council to monitor domestic policy making. Ford had kept the Domestic Policy Council to monitor domestic policy making. Carter had changed the name to the Domestic Policy Group, but its role also was to monitor domestic policy making. Reagan came in, didn't want anything to do with the same names, and he created the Office of Policy Development, the OPD. But its role was essentially the same as it had been in the past three administrations, that is to coordinate domestic policy making. Now, Reagan, more than any other president, really took control of this process. He put in charge of the Office of Domestic Policy Making a young man named Martin Anderson. And Martin Anderson had been in the Nixon administration. Surprise, surprise, he'd been an assistant to John Ehrlichman. He also worked with Arthur Burns. He had been Reagan's director of economic policy making. He was an economics professor at Stanford. And Martin Anderson came into the White House and said, I know what we need. I've been there. We need to develop a very careful working relationship between the White House and the cabinet in which the absolutely controls policy development, that the departments are not out there creating their own policies. Well, how do you do that? Anderson created what's called cabinet councils, and they were working groups of cabinet officers that met weekly to discuss the president's policy options. So the cabinet council idea was the key to the centralized policy development system that the Reagan administration set in place. The cabinet councils were cabinet officers sitting around a big table like this in the Roosevelt Room in the White House, and they met every week with Reagan. And Reagan would sit there and tell his cabinet officers exactly what he wanted to do. And they would talk about initiatives, and Reagan would say no or yes. So you, the cabinet office is right from the beginning, got their information from the president. We in political science refer to this as keeping the cabinet officers in the presidential orbit. That's very important, ensuring that policy remains in the presidential orbit and not moved out to the departments. No other president had done this. Bush doesn't do it. Clinton doesn't do it. Reagan is the only president in what we call the postmodern presidency that actually sat weekly. Now, we're not talking about cabinet meetings. He had those too. We're talking about cabinet council meetings, which had five or six cabinet officers, and he met with all the different cabinet council meetings, cabinet councils. There were five, for what it's worth. He met with these cabinet councils, and he talked every week with the different members about where he wanted them to go. Now, Anderson very carefully made sure that they met regularly. They met in the White House, and the cabinet officers knew exactly that they were part of the president's team. The problem with cabinet officers is they easily feel that they're not part of the president's team, but what? Part of the department's team. That they are the department spokesman to the president. What Reagan wanted is to make sure that these people were the president's spokesman to the department. And to do that, you have to keep working with them and keep meeting with them. Remember, when you go back, when you're a cabinet secretary, and I understand that Larry Eagleburger is here, so he's a great person to talk to about this, that when you're a cabinet secretary, you have a huge, magnificent office, and you have 12 secretaries out there, and a telephone with 400 buttons on it, and people fawning over you. Now, that's wonderful. It builds your ego, and you have people calling you up saying, can we do this, can we do this? And you suddenly feel very departmentally based. And then you go over to the White House, and you're not a big muckety-muck anymore. You're just one of a group, and you're one of a very large group. And on top of that, there are all these White House staff that think they're more important than you are. So it was a very important part of the Reagan administration's effort to control policymaking to reduce the image of the White House staff as big muckety-mucks and to keep the cabinet officers feeling in the White House that they were big muckety-mucks. Very, very important. In addition, what Anderson established were departmental working groups of deputy secretaries. And these people met not in the departments, but in the old executive office building. And they met regularly, also with Anderson's staff, to understand what the cabinet councils were doing and to understand where the president wanted the departments to go. So Anderson was trying to gain not only control of that senior level, but that next level, the undersecretaries, the deputy secretaries, the assistant secretaries, to ensure they also remained presidentially based and not departmentally based. In addition to this massive effort to keep all of these people in the presidential orbit, remember there are 5,000 presidential appointments, and there's 3.5 million people in the federal government. So there's very few people that you can really control. And what happened is that other presidents lost control even of their 5,000. Reagan worked very hard at maintaining control of these people. One thing that other administrations had done is they had abdicated the role of personnel director, and they had let the cabinet officers bring in their own people. The Reagan White House said every single one of those 5,000 jobs, presidentially appointed jobs, are going to be controlled out of the White House, and Pendleton James is going to approve every single one. So every single job in the departments was approved by the White House. Now, what kind of people would you think those would be? Reagan supporters? What else? Absolute conservatives? People with a very narrow political agenda. And who did that agenda mirror? The president's. So now we have the cabinet officers in this very narrow field, and everyone under them in this very narrow field. All of these people are constantly going over to the White House to be spoon-fed, this is what the president wants, this is what the president wants. In addition, Reagan, who, as you know, is a very humble and gentle individual personally, said, I want to meet all these other people. And he would regularly have all of these lower-level people over to the White House for White House dinners, White House receptions. Do you want to use my box at the Kennedy Center? Do you want to use my box at Ford's Theater? So what happens to these people? Who do they feel loyal to? The departments of the president. The president. In addition, that third tier, the really the lowest level of people, every single January he would meet in Constitutional Hall with all of the rest of the political executives for 2.5 hours every January, and it was called the Executive Forum, to talk to them one-on-one. So all of these people felt a loyalty to this man and to this agenda, and we'd never seen that before. Now, in addition to this policymaking, am I done? You ready to stop me? Okay. Just tell me, because I'll go on forever. I love this. In addition, what Reagan did was not just have a policymaking process controlled by the White House staff and all the people controlled from the White House, but he set up what's called the Legislative Strategy Group. Now, here we are, our cabinet group, and we've all just developed a series of wonderful policy proposals. And the cabinet agrees on it, the president agrees on it, but what could be a stumbling block here? Exactly, Congress. Well, if we have to go back to our cabinet group and our departmental working groups, we're going to have a time delay. So the Reagan White House said, well, we've done our bit in bringing the cabinet into this. Let's move on. And they had a man named Jim Baker, whose name you remember well, went on to do other things. Jim Baker said, you give me those proposals, and I know what to do with them. And Jim Baker would go over to Congress with Max Friedersdorf, who was the congressional liaison, and they'd work it through Congress. And if members of Congress said, gee, I don't like this, this, or this, rather than submitting that policy initiative back to the cabinet or back to the departments or back to the cabinet councils, they simply rewrote them on the spot to meet congressional objectives. And that's what was called the Legislative Strategy Group. And that was a huge benefactor to the Reagan White House because it allowed their proposals to move quickly through the legislative process without going back to that departmental process. None of the other administrations have figured this out, and neither Bush nor Clinton have been successful at this. One of the great stumbling blocks in the Clinton administration today is you see very little moving through the legislative process, and that's because Clinton has reverted back to the Carter system of giving all of this power to the cabinet offices, with the exception of health care. Health care is being managed by the White House, but the rest of their programs are moving right through the departments, and they're having great problems at getting a presidential approval, at roundtabling them to resolve interjurisdictional problems or to move them through the legislative process. Baker was very successful at this, and he also had a great working relationship with Max Friedersdorf. I can't underscore to you enough the value of chemistry in these working relationships, and that's one thing that Pendleton James understood, is that if you're going to forge a strong group of people to move an entire nation forward, there has to be one, a shared vision. These people have to understand where it is this administration is going. And two, there has to be a personal chemistry among these people. They have to like each other, have to be willing to work with each other. And it's up to the president, it's up to that White House staff to forge that working relationship among these people. If you're going to resolve interjurisdictional disputes, or you're going to resolve complexities in multi-departmental policy initiatives, you need to be able to call people up and talk to them. You need to know who they are. The problem with most administrations, and there's a great book written about it by Hugh Hecklow, it's called The Government of Strangers, is that you have department heads who don't know each other from diddly squat. You certainly have deputy secretaries who don't know each other. Now, how can you have a government that works if people don't know each other, if people can't call each other up on the phone, if people can't have lunch? Well, that was the great success of the Reagan administration, this personal camaraderie and chemistry that was built in the policymaking centers of this administration. That's an overview of the strength of the first administration. During the second administration, we had somewhat of a change, and we had Donald Regan come in, who was much more of a personal, he wanted to focus much more power in his hands, and he wanted much more control over everything. And that, to some extent, hurt the Reagan administration. And one of the problems with that was Iran-Contra, which he, of course, refuses to acknowledge any association with. But Ken Duberstein and Howard Baker eventually took over, the Howard Baker first, and Ken Duberstein eventually took over from Donald Regan, and the system reverted very quickly back to where it was. So for the next 2.5 years of the Reagan administration, we had the same strong policymaking system that we had had in the first half. Well, where does this leave us? It leaves us with a very strong model for a system that works. Now, one of the problems with the Bush administration is that we never saw that strong policy development system. Part of the reason was is the Reagan people and the Bush people can't stand each other. They truly, personally dislike each other. It's not so much that they are certainly philosophically opposed. The Reagan people are much more conservative than the Bush supporters. President Bush is, in fact, much more liberal on domestic policy, as you all know. He got moved into the conservative wing more by politics than his own personal beliefs. And the people who surrounded George Bush were, in fact, much more liberal and moderate than were the Reagan people. But they personally disliked each other so intensely that any system that Ronald Reagan had set in place must naturally be bad. So they simply threw it out, and they tried to develop another system. But it just didn't work. And Roger Porter, who was on Reagan's domestic policy staff and then moved into head Bush's domestic policy staff, was absolutely cut out from the inner circle. Now, why they kept Roger Porter is a mystery to me, and I've talked to these people, and really nobody is quite clear on why Roger Porter was kept. And that was the great feeling of the domestic policy process, is they kept someone they didn't like. The Clinton administration is moving back to the system. As you all know, October 1st, President Clinton announced with great joy that he was cutting the White House staff by 25% and moving to a cabinet-based policy development system. The role of the White House staff was to support, and I quote, the cabinet in their decision-making, that the policies that came out of this administration would be cabinet-based. Now, I suggest to you that Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton is going to have a great deal of trouble in the next election, because he will not be able to forge the kinds of policies that he himself wants, that those policies are departmentally based and do not meet the goals and objectives of his White House, and they certainly don't meet the political needs of the administration. And unless Bill Clinton moves to gain control of the policy process through the White House, that he will suffer the same defeat that George Bush did. And with that, I will open it up for some questions and answers.
Very thoughtful, President Colonel Pete. Dr. Boyne,
your thesis out of water, explain Sam Pierce.
Oh, Sam Pierce I meet often with. Sam Pierce, all of my work for what I've interviewed most of the White House staff and cabinet and almost every administration. I have thousands of documents. I spend many, many weeks going into presidential papers at presidential libraries. So I interview people, then I go to the White House, to the presidential papers and the presidential archives to support it. Sam Pierce is someone, and then after I write all this stuff up, after I've interviewed them, I always send it to them. And every time I write on Reagan, I send it to all the cabinet officers. Sam Pierce always writes me back and says, can I meet with you on this? So I meet with him all the time. And Sam Pierce was brought in by Pendleton James with a mandate to cut the funding programs of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And he did that at the beginning of the administration. And then he said to Martin Anderson, gee, I think that perhaps there are some of these programs, and specifically the Section 8 subsidized housing program, that we should perhaps not cut so deeply. And Anderson actually supported that. And the funding for the Section 8 subsidized housing program then went up. So there, Sam Pierce took a stand, and he was supported for it. And one thing that I've often talked to him, I said, Mr. Secretary, what would you do if Martin Anderson hadn't approved it? He said, well, I go to the president. And he went to the president on a number of issues. And the president, he said, supported him on most of the times that he went to the president. I said, what would you have done if the president hadn't supported you? And I said, that would have been the end of it. I would have done what he told me to do. Now, the problem is that that was true of every one of his cabinet officers. If they went to the president and the president said, I don't support that, they said, yes, sir, and they followed what he wanted to do. Other administrations, the cabinet officers would not have taken quite so kindly the president turning off one of their programs and would have gone to their own constituency, whether it be the natural constituents of the department or their natural constituents in Congress.
I thought that Reagan once addressed him as Mr. Mayor. Didn't he get a little confused
with
who Sam first?
He didn't. The first few cabinet meetings, he would walk by him and not know who he was. That's very true. Yes, sir.
So when you talk about the presidential staff under these various presidents, roughly how big or what numbers are we talking about?
Well, from when to when?
Well, under, the presidents you mentioned, up and down.
Starting with Nixon?
You will.
Okay. You're talking about only the narrow White House staff or the entire White House staff?
Well, not the cooks.
Okay. Well, for my purposes, I look at what's called, quote unquote, the policymakers within the White House. And that's a term that, in fact, the Office of Policy Development has internally developed. And as I said, it started, it actually began with Richard Nixon. If you begin with Richard Nixon, you're talking about a very, very small six people were in the Urban Affairs Council. And Arthur Burns, who managed economic policy in the White House, had, I think, two assistants. Now, John Ehrlichman, when he took over, started to use what's called the detail. If you know how White House staffs, the budget that you see for White House is quite different than what's really there. But they have detailees. These are people that they bring in from the departments to work for them. So you're never really sure how many people are in the White House because it depends on how astute they are at bringing in detailees. But if you look only at the numbers that are given to us from the budget of the White House staff, it began to emerge in Nixon, and we moved up into about 20. At the end of Ehrlichman, at the height of Ehrlichman, he had about 45. Carter brought that down. This is domestic policy making, brought that down. And at the end of Reagan, we were up to 91. These are senior policymakers. Bush brought that down again. There were 70 in the Bush administration. And Clinton is trying to bring that down again. So the height was in 1989. At the end, on January 20th, there were more people in the White House than we've seen under either Bush or Clinton.
And they're mostly housed right there in the White House or in the executive office?
The senior policymakers are in the White House, and the people with the title Special Assistant and Deputy Assistant in the old executive office building.
Warren Henry.
You described a model of presidential government. Policy making, which is a natural one for presidents, but you haven't really told us what you think of it in terms of governance. I mean, the presidential model contains some assumptions about Congress and the bureaucracy and what your party is and some other things. Some would say it's a model you described is deadlock. As a matter of governance, in the long run, how do you see this?
Let me focus, and I didn't get a chance. That's a very, very good question. That one of the problems that emerges from a centralized policymaking system that is one that has enormous control over by the White House is that you don't have the opportunity. The departments are the great equalizer, because within the departments you have the constituents' viewpoint, you have the public viewpoint, you have legislative needs, but the policies developed in the departments really are policies that satisfy as many of those political blocks as you can. A White House-based system are developed by people in a vacuum. Policies that absolutely meet the president's political needs, but policies that don't meet the political needs, as you say, of all of these other disparate groups. What Reagan did is that he was able to bring in the departments into this policy process, that the White House staff would say to the cabinet officers, this is where you want to take these policies. They would not specifically develop these policies. They'd simply set a broad agenda that these are where we want to go. And then they'd go to the departments and let them focus it among their natural constituents, bring it back to these working groups, and they'd go back through this interaction. And that's what the success was. It met the criteria that you've established. It tried to reduce the gridlock. There will always be gridlock. There's no question about that. You can't get rid of it. It's built into our institutional framework. But you can mitigate it. And Reagan was quite successful at mitigating that gridlock.
Other questions? Bill Wendell?
Yes, sir.
Doesn't the president really have to start with the votes? Reagan and FDR could have any cabinet they wanted. So I don't know how they are about Francis Perkins. But if he doesn't have that, and if he knows how to take advantage of it, which Reagan did, and FDR had his very savvy
brain trust.
What do they call it?
Brain trust.
Brain trust, yes. But if you don't have the votes, and then you try to appoint men only, contemporaries, conservatives, you're going to get taken all apart in the media and in Congress, and you're going to be
sabotaged from the beginning.
Massacred.
Yes. Your point is well taken. I would argue that what the American public wants to see is that the mandate that they elected their president to accomplish is in fact accomplished, and that they are less concerned with the blueprint of people surrounding the president than the successful initiation, implementation, and legislative package of a series of programs that they elected that person to move forward. The American public elected Ronald Reagan to do several things: to reduce the federal budget, to reduce the federal workforce, to increase the responsibility of states into the policymaking process, to reduce taxes. He did all that.
Which he had laid out, yes.
And which he accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
That the American public wants to see the fruition of that mandate. What I'm arguing is that the more people you have around you that are absolutely attuned to accomplishing that mandate, rather than pursuing a series of policies that they find their departments would rather move forward, that you will receive the respect and then the votes of the American public. That what George Bush and Bill Clinton didn't have, one, is a very clear, Ronald Reagan in office was a very clear agenda, so it was much easier to surround yourself with people that agreed with that agenda than either George Bush. What would you argue were the four things that George Bush wanted to do when he got into office?
He didn't know.
What are the four things that Bill Clinton wants to do now that he's in office?
Depends on what day of the week you're...
Well, change. Yeah. We want change is what we elected this man. But it's very difficult without the specifics of that. And national health care, I would argue, is Jim Carville's. I'm from Pennsylvania. And Jim Carville conceived this out of absolutely nowhere in the Harris-Walford-Dick Thornburgh Senate race because they needed something. And Carville just came up with it in a dream one night. I'm dead serious. We're talking about it. Bill Clinton was not wed to national health care until Jim Carville said, look, let's go with it. That the trouble with the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, it's difficult to surround yourself with people with a shared vision and a shared agenda if you don't have a very clear-cut agenda. And it's not the topic for this discussion, but another discussion is that presidents also need to have a very narrow focus. that you need to narrow your focus to 4 or 5 very clear items in which you can deal during the course of the administration. And one of Bill Clinton's objectives early in the election was to bring gays into the military. It's a very divisive issue that any student of the presidency would tell him, don't begin your presidency with a divisive issue, because you have, in fact, only 4 years, three in all reality, because 1 year is campaigning and you're not there. You really only have 3 years to get your agenda before the public, and you have to have a very narrow agenda. And to wage your battles on a divisive issue is political suicide. And I've been doing some work in the White House recently, and I was down last week working, and I don't want to bore you, but this is a funny story, is we're working with junior staff, not senior staff, not the Mac McClartys, the Alexis Hermans, but the people under them. There's nobody over 25. And we were sitting there talking, and one of the people in our group was Dwight Ink, who I'm sure you know. And Dwight Ink was talking to them about the role of the White House. And what we're trying to do is tell these people what you do. There's no training ground for working in the White House. So Dwight is trying to tell these people some of the different presidential tactics. And he was talking about Lyndon Johnson. We might as well have been talking about Abraham Lincoln. And then we were talking about Elliot Richardson. They didn't know who Elliot Richardson was. And this is unfortunately, this is not a statement about Bill Clinton the man or Bill Clinton the president, or his policies. This is a statement about how one runs the White House and what are the types of people one put in there and what are the organizational structures that one institutes for a clearly functioning White House.
To be mischievous, Mr. Newman has the next question, but I'd like to ask him if Mr. Whiteside picked you because you agreed with him, and also did you pick your staff at Dun & Bradstreet in terms of whether they agreed with you? You don't have to answer that question.
In spite of your effort to divert my thoughts, I'd like to ask a question about the impressed by your comments about the Reagan administration. I think my question has to do with the interfacing between governance methodology and political philosophies. I judge from what you say that a fairly uniform political philosophy was necessary in order to make the Reagan governance successful in achieving its objectives. Now, would you hold the same view with respect to Mr. Clinton, who was elected with 43% of the public vote, indicating that there was a wide scattering of political belief outside, whereas under the Reagan's elections, the choices were somewhat less?
That's a very good question. I guess I would answer it in that we are electing a president. The president is, in my view, the most powerful person in the world, not just the United States, but in the world today. And what we're electing is a leader. And that the key to leadership is having a vision and having an agenda. And that's what we're electing. We're electing someone that has a vision for this country. And if you don't agree with it, throw the man out, throw the woman out in 4 years. But that person has hopefully told you, this is what I'm running on, this is what I hope to do for this country, and this is my agenda. And then that person moves on with that vision. And that's what leadership is all about.
since I couldn't arouse Mr. Newman to draw on his experience, maybe I can give you three names. Donald Regan, already four, Bill Casey and Ollie North, and Jim Baker. Did they share Reagan's philosophy, do you think? Regan has said that his problem for the first term was that he could never get, in the beginning, never get through the California mafia, and that they blocked him at every point, and that he had to find out what the president thought about economic policy by reading the newspapers. Casey and Ollie North seemed to operate in a little orbit of their own. And Jim Baker, in a way, is maybe an exception, isn't he, in that his political philosophy may have been more closely associated with George Bush.
The question. I'm sorry.
What does that do to the concept? Does it modify or just exceptions?
I think Donald Regan, as you point out, was not part of the inner circle. He didn't last very long. And Martin Anderson, when he was Secretary of the Treasury, very tightly controlled what Regan did in policymaking. With regard to Iran-Contra, I would argue that Ronald Reagan quite clearly knew what was going on, and that what these people were doing fit exactly in the mold that I was talking about, and that they were working to fulfill the Reagan agenda. Reagan had said, in no uncertain terms, this is what I want to do in Nicaragua, this is what I want to do to support democracy, I want to support freedom fighters. And that they were implementing that, which he had said over and over and over again.
Baker.
Jim Baker, in my opinion, was a political realist. Ed Meese was absolutely wedded to the Reagan political doctrine. Michael Deaver was not as wedded to the Reagan political doctrine, but was absolutely personally loyal to Reagan. And whatever Ronald Reagan wanted was fine with him. And Jim Baker came in there as the political realist. And he realized that his career was quite definitely going to be enhanced by being part of this White House. And that he was perfectly willing to fine-tune his political objectives to meet those of the president. And never once, if you read any of the correspondence, never once does Jim Baker argue against him. And Jim Baker, in fact, says, sounds good to me, and goes along with everybody else. But there's never an instance that I found, and that's, again, not to say never, but there appears to be none or very few instances that Jim Baker stood up and tried to bring that agenda in another direction.
Yes.
Would you define a mandate? Is the election of a president, does that become a mandate?
That's a mandate.
Is it a matter of degree?
The mandate is that you've elected this president to do essentially whatever he wants to do at that point. That he is the victor, as in a war. And the victor can therefore move forward based on what he's told the public, refine what he's told the public, and then try and accomplish that. A mandate is simply winning.
It's not a matter of degree.
No, it's not a matter of degree. In presidential elections, someone wins and one or more people lose. The person that wins is now the president. He takes over the leadership of this country and he moves that country in the direction as best he can.
What about Reykjavik? Was Reagan's idea of eradicating all nuclear weapons that she tried out, was that part of his mandate?
I am not a foreign policy specialist, and I would hate to move into those discussions. That's your area of expertise. You can answer that far, far better than I can.
Please.
I wanted to follow up on your question because I think, you know, it's so important and it's so astounding that Reagan didn't have more opposition to his vision. And it seems to me that one of the ways, in addition to the way he organized his White House, was that he had such incredible control of the media. They put out every morning their line, and they made sure that this is what the media brought to the public.
Yeah, has anybody here worked in the press? You have, I know. Mm-hmm. The job of the White House press is very difficult. They have deadlines to meet. And every morning at 8 o'clock, the people that have the little badges to get into the White House, there's about 1,200 of them now, go in and they hear the babble that comes out of the White House press secretary. Now, most of these people have a radio show, or they have a deadline for their newspaper, or they have a deadline for NBC News, or whatever it is they have a deadline for. And they have to show something and do something. Now, a skilled White House press office will give these people as much information on something relatively interesting as they possibly can. The skill of Marlon Fitzwater, not Marlon Fitzwater, who was the Reagan press secretary, not David Gergen. Larry Speaks, thanks. Of Larry Speaks and David Gergen when he was the communications director, is that they pounded out unbelievable amounts of information to these people. And they controlled what it is got on the evening news. They didn't let these people go off on their own and forage for something to show on TV that night. They fed it to them. So when we talk about control of information, in large part, what we're talking about is that their ability to give the information right to them and keep them from going out on their own.
We've gone over our usual time deadline, and I know that many of you would have further questions. Maybe you'd ask them of our speaker. I think the only thing remaining to be said is that Mr. Brownell was right.